Richard O'Dwyer is studying for a degree at Sheffield Hallam University. He's an interactive media student with a talent for web design. Last November, he was in his student digs when there was a knock on the door.
Some police officers came into his room and they had some people from America with them. And they said they wanted to talk to him about his website that he'd made. He came home then and he was really upset.
Richard's website was called TV Shack and it provided links to other websites where you could download pirated films and TV shows. The site has since been shut down and now has a message saying it's under control of the US authorities. He now faces extradition to the United States on charges of infringing copyright. Richard's case echoes that of Gary McKinnon, the British computer expert accused of hacking into the Pentagon. He spent years fighting extradition to the US. In the case of Richard O'Dwyer, his mother, Julia, believes he should be tried in this country.
Richard's not been to America since he was five. How can it be anything to do with America? It doesn't seem right.
I'll put off thinking about the next hearing until closer time. Otherwise, it just gets too stressful and that.
Increasingly, major American copyright holders are clamping down on file sharing of movies and TV shows. The penalties can be severe.
Well, Hollywood's been very aggressive in combating piracy. It costs something nearly like 50,000 jobs, untold billions of dollars in lost revenue to the studios. So they've gone overseas to Asia, South America, and throughout Europe to find pirates and bring them to justice.
Julia is now pinning her hopes on changes to the extradition law. Otherwise, her son could be on his way to face US justice and a possible jail sentence.
Well, Mum Julia joins us now, and Shami Chakrabarty from Liberty as well. Just firstly, Julia, if you can just bring us up to date then, at what stage are we at?
Well, today we've got to go to the court for the first part of the proper extradition hearing this morning. And at that hearing, the barrister will argue that what Richard's website did is not a crime in this country. Mm-hmm. I'll try to argue that.
And how is he bearing up?
He tries to block it out, really, most of the time. He doesn't start to worry about it until now, when there's a hearing, when something's happening. He's just trying to carry on with his university studies and life, really, trying to carry on as normal. Mm-hmm. Leave the worry to me.
Easier said than done, though, perhaps.
Shami,
as Julia mentioned, it is fact, he hasn't broken any laws in the UK, although that might be changing, I believe, as the laws change. So how has it come to this?
I'm afraid that it's just become too easy to parcel people off from Britain. Now, don't get me wrong, I think most of us agree that there should be extradition laws in the world so that people can't escape justice by leaving a country where they've committed a crime, and that's really important. I want to be clear about that. But at the same time, to be taken from your family and from your home and parcelled off to another part of the world with a different legal system can be punishment in itself. That's before you've even faced trial. And I think what we need now is to put a bit of compassion, a bit of discretion, a bit of proportionality back into the system. You've heard from Julia that that her son would happily face up to whatever it is he's accused of doing here in Britain. Now, that may be a civil matter, for example. An alleged breach of copyright, or if the people of Britain decide that it's such a serious matter, maybe that they'll make it a crime. But it's just disproportionate to take a young man like that from his home and send him off to another jurisdiction. This is not alleged murder here.
Okay,
this is not alleged rape, and you need a bit of proportionality before you do this.
At some point, and maybe Julie, you can answer this as well. At some point, that will be the case, won't it? Because this will become illegal fairly soon. We understand within the UK. But for the time being, it's not. So,
well, if it's
Richard
not,
accepts that he has
Well, there's the civil law. We have the civil law as well as the criminal law.
Should there be some punishment? What is the answer to this if there is no extradition and he can't be seen by authorities in America?
Well, we have a completely fine legal system in this country. What's wrong with that?
If it's the case that it isn't a crime in this country, then I just say it's disproportionate to take him from this country where he did whatever it is he did and where it isn't a crime. And if a loophole has been discovered, then fair enough, that can be plugged. This is not alleged murder and rape we're talking about here. Let's remember that there are people in bedrooms and offices and studies around the country going online and allegedly committing all sorts of speech offences and other offences all over the world just by sitting here in Britain. Britain. And I say it is disproportionate to parcel all those people off to any country that wants them without having proper justice and a bit of compassion shown in a UK court.
Does it sound like they could be trying to make an example of him at this stage? It actually mightn't go to the stage that we are talking about where he is extradited.
Well, it's a pretty big way of trying to make an example, I feel, and in line with what Sharmi said, proportionality. Mm. You know, I have a letter from the DPP's office saying this is not considered to be a serious matter.
Well, if it's not considered to be a serious matter, he shouldn't be parcelled off to America for it.
Why take these measures to deal with that? Other cases have been brought in this country for copyright infringement. We have a legal system. Why not use it? Why hand somebody over to the Americans for for a non-serious matter?
Mm-hmm. I think everybody watching should be a little bit worried about our extradition laws, because it could, it's her son today, it could easily be someone else's tomorrow.
Give me back the internet. Give me that the internet. Give me back the internet. Give me that the internet.
American media is a business.
Business has a mission, not to inform, but to entertain them.
It's never hearts and minds. It's never the threat of communism or the spread of peace. It's business.
The problem with the truth is that the truth is. You can't really shift the truth. That's why it's the truth. No matter how many facts you try to throw at it, no matter your angle or perceptions, you can't really spin the truth. You can spin perception, and the perception may affect your thought process and therefore your reality view of the truth. But the truth is.
Hopefully, in the not-too-distant future, we'll be able to merge our system with theirs, and of course with those of the rest of the world, to form some kind of a world brotherhood, a world union, a world government, to be exact.
The fact that the Washington Post had to brief America that Homeland Security finds it okay to detain your electronic media, your laptop or anything, your iPod, when you come into an airport in America, a foreigner or an American citizen.
One thing is for certain, and that is that there's a lot of crazy stuff flying through the air. It doesn't matter who's responsible for it, but what does matter is that there's a lot of different material that we can't see that is being broadcast through the air. Now, it's true that maybe some of it out there is mind control.
And now,
the news for you.
And it's a new day out here on the internet. Today is Monday, January 23rd, 2012. This day in history, 1935, the first beer in a can went on sale. Canned beer, yes, canned beer, the thing we all love, made its debut today in 1935. There's a partnership with the American Can Company and the Gottfried Kruger Brewing Company. Exciting, exciting, exciting. Now, the concept of canned beer proved to be a hard sell, but I guess Kruger's overcame its initial reservations, and it was the first brewery to get into it. And now, cans make up about half of the $20 billion U.S. beer market. $20 billion, with a B, dollars. And you are listening to the brand new blasphemy that is Newsreel X. The new WOG Global Sit Rep and Core Political Tyranny, Technology and Trends for Your Head, Space, and Timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech, and you are too just by listening. And yes, you heard that right. You heard right. Newsreel X is now going to be broadcast on Rant Radio Talk. Can you believe that? Three episodes in, and the big man called and said, "You're in, boy. Make us proud." And I'm going to try, Sim. Now, we are not broadcasting from Second Life still. We are broadcasting from the cynical, cold First Life. You know that place. The floor is sticky. The beer is warm. And the only women here are the dried-up, retired prostitutes sitting on their bar stools. No, really, it's not that bad. But you can follow along and check the facts on my Facebook. That's facebook.com/newsreelx. You are free to distribute, massacre, murder, masturbate on, or anything else you want to do through this podcast as you see fit. So, on Get the Fuck Out of My Car News. Yes, that's right. David Hasselhoff will help us in this one. But today, the Supreme Court rejected GPS tracking in your car without a warrant. Woo! Listen to that. In the 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court said that prolonged GPS tracking was in need of a warrant. So let's celebrate. Get out of my car. Come on, everybody. That's just too far. That's right, government. I couldn't care less. Get your GPS off my car. Come on, you know the words. Sing along. Get out of my car. That's right. You tell him, Hasselhoff.
Get her out of here.
Sometimes. Sometimes you need to laugh a little bit, or you just end up crying. Well, the true funny thing is David Hasselhoff have two things in common. One is we both drive black cars, and the other one is there's embarrassing video of us drunk trying to eat hamburgers. But anyway, we can celebrate a little bit in the fact that we can't be tracked without a warrant with a GPS attached to our car. They'll just track us from our cell phones. But it's the little successes we have. But if everyone knew news, this is a great site that was pointed out to me by Mute. I used to go by Nephilim. This is a website for those type of people that you're looking to maybe open their eyes about what's really going on in this country and the world. It goes along to thoughts that I have about when you need to introduce someone to be, bringing them into the Matrix. You don't want to be telling them the big truths, because the big truths are frightening. Make us seem like crazy conspiracy theorists and make it very easy for people to just laugh and walk away. But if going to ifeveryoneknew.com, it gives, what is it here? I think it's five or six points, and they're mind blowers. So let me just start this out. They all have, they're all referenced, and very, very nice interface on this website, too. When you first get there, it just shows, like, the bullet points, and then when you click on them, it gives you the references. But first point, the prison system in the United States is a profit-making industry. Private corporations operate 200 facilities and more nationwide and are traded on the New York Stock Exchange. So, we'll just go into this a little bit. In the United States, prison privatization, say that three times fast, in its current form, began in 1984 as a result on the war on drugs. And people wonder why our government won't legalize drugs. It's too profitable. While crime rates otherwise remained steady back to the 1925, the number of arrests quickly exploded. Well, that's a fun thing that they're even pushing more and more, is that if you make everything a crime, everyone's a criminal. While the war on drugs initially had a small impact on incarceration, it was President Reagan, his Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986 that kick-started the whole prison boom. So this goes in further, talks about how different legislation and buying off of Congress, and even getting into the money that is skimmed off of phone calls out of the prison system. If you've ever received or made a phone call from jail or prison, you'd be very surprised in how much it costs. But here it says the average phone call in the United States is 3 cents per minute. Inmates and their families end up paying between 16 cents and, more aptly, $2.50 per minute. The profits are then split between the carrier and the government body who awarded the contract to begin with. So, looks like millions and millions of dollars just on the gouging of phone calls. Let's get into the second part, which I may talk more about later. Six corporations control virtually all American media. News Corp owns over 27 television stations and over 150 newspapers. Time Warner has over 100 subsidiaries, including CNN, Time Magazine, and the CW. So, this is a pointing out the conglomeration of media in our country. The Big Six, who own pretty much everything except for fine alternative media like Rand Radio. Thank you, Sim. In a democratic system, the most powerful force is the media. The media shapes the beliefs, changes perspectives, and informs the public on which choices to make at the ballot box. So they can, you know, put dye bulb machines in and change the stats afterward. Anyway, the media decides which voices are heard or silenced, which issues get covered, Ron Paul, or ignored, which songs you get to hear, and which wars will receive public support. So, this goes into pointing out that all our media is owned by six companies that like to work with each other as well as pay off both parties and really have the news, money, and politics all wrapped together. Let's see what it goes into here. The Big Six is a term often used in describing the state of media consolidation in the U.S. Virtually everything you see, hear, read, and watch is a product of one of the six media companies: NBC Universal, Walt Disney, News Corp, Time Warner, Viacom, and CBS. They each own a multitude of news stations, film studios, newspapers, internet companies, etc., etc., etc. So you get to go and watch the brand new movie with those attractive actors and actresses that was based on the book published by the same media company with that theme song that was written by your government-appointed rock group. And to top it all off, you get to watch advertisements and listen to advertisements on the company-owned television stations and radio stations. It's scary. I say that a lot, but I am frightened. A lot of this does frighten me. And when you really put it in simple terms and see it in black and white and see how it really is, it can scare the shit out of you. But it just shows how much harder alternative media, alternative artists, musicians, you know, anything else that falls into the art category, writers and movie makers, how large of a mountain they're trying to climb. Because every outlet, everything, you turn on the television, you turn on the radio, you go in and go into Barnes & Noble, it's all the same. It's what they want you to hear, what they want you to see. And even the stuff that seems edgy, you know, you like, as I mentioned before, with Daily Show Colbert Report, is they're like our government-approved satire. It's government-approved revolution. You know, it keeps you on your couch laughing, but also getting angry about how things are and how politicians are fucking us. At the same time that, you know, they're keeping you on the couch. They're keeping you docile. They're keeping you from getting out there and actually creating a revolution, getting out there and causing something. Okay, let's get back to five facts that everyone should know. So here we go. So we go into the next fact, fact three, I believe. The FBI admits to infiltrating and disrupting peaceful political groups in the United States. This includes the women's and civil rights movements, where their members were targeted, beaten, imprisoned, and assassinated. Following the end of the Second World War, the spread of communism was considered to be the number one threat in the United States. The Soviet Union's ability to secure a nuclear weapon, coupled with the communist ideology spreading across the globe, fueled a state of fear during this time. Even in the United States, the Communist Party was gaining traction as a legitimate political party. Imagine that. Imagine if we had a multi-party system. The CIA was tasked with combating this threat that was both abroad and at home. So in 1956, the FBI instituted a counterintelligence program. which among its goals was to maintain the existing social and political order, which is what they're still trying to do to this day. This initially meant targeting different groups, including the communist New Communist Party. However, operating secrecy with very little oversight, the scope was later widened to include any group the FBI deemed subversive. Among these groups were the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement, and the growing anti-war movement. Individual students demonstrating against the Vietnam War were also targeted by the FBI, along with American luminaries such as Martin Luther King and Albert Einstein. Knowledge is a bad thing. Okay, on to point four. In 1977, it was revealed that random American citizens were abducted and tortured for research by the CIA. Project MKUltra was the codename for a series of covert activities in the early 1950s. Following the defeat of the Third Reich in 1945, the predecessor to the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, sought to recruit Nazi scientists for employment by the United States. Under the direction and supervision of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Operation Paperclip, that's a good one, recruited Nazi scientists who had broad skill set ranging from rocketry to torture. Do you put that on your resume? Yeah, I could type 85 words a minute. I'm Cisco certified, and I'm good at torture, and I don't mean just in relationships. Using the newly gathered intelligence, the United States Navy started Project Chatter. Then the CIA started Project Artichoke, both of which study the effects of drugs for the purposes of interrogation. The CIA's project used hypnosis, forced morphine addiction, and the use of other chemicals and methods. The intelligence divisions of every military branch, in addition to the FBI, were eventually operating under the Project Artichoke banner. So here, the last point, the five facts that everyone should know. A plan to attack American cities to justify war with Cuba was approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1962, then rejected by President Kennedy. But Operation Northwoods remained classified for 35 years. In 1959, an armored revolution by Fidel Castro succeeded in overthrowing the U.S.-backed Cuban dictator. Castro became the first communist leader in the Western Hemisphere, just 90 miles from the American mainland. Operation Northwoods was a plan drawn up by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1962, which outlined ways to generate support for American military operations in Cuba. In a nutshell, it consisted of a number of attacks, some real, some simulated, that'd be performed by American forces and then blamed on the Cuban government. The document, which has since been declassified and can be read in its entirety over a cup of coffee, outlined the plans that range from blowing up unmanned drones and performing mock funerals to conducting legitimate attacks on U.S. military installations in American cities. At one point, it states, we could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington. This is a good example of the old problem-reaction-solution motif that's been used before. You know, to create a little bit of panic, point at an enemy, get your troops riled up, and here we go. Time to run off to a war or two. And in the words of Fugazi, give me the shot, give me the cure news.
I hate being sick.
You don't want to stop your life because you're sick. You don't want to stop your family's life because you're sick.
I've got to support my family. Missing work's just not an option for me. So a flu shot is an important thing I do every year.
You have to do your part to be healthy.
Whether it's being in sports or being in school, it's just not fun to be sick, and you need to make sure that you are immunized so that you don't get sick or you don't spread sicknesses.
You can't play football when you're sick.
Get vaccinated. Stop the flu.
Do it for me.
Do it for me.
Do it for your family.
Do it.
Do it for your community.
do it for me, the Dark Lord Satan.
Why do we offer flu shots at Walgreens every day?
Because in the world order, and Satan tells you to do it.
Satan, you slay me. You're hilarious. But no, it could be by some unnamed Walgreens employees that the reason that they are offering flu shots and forcing them on you is that the stores are being rewarded with incentives and employees are threatened with reprimand if they don't meet a certain goal of pushing customers to get flu shots. Talking about this is something that I wasn't even thinking about bringing on the show, but I was on the phone speaking with a friend of mine and mentioning about how you can't walk through a Walgreens and buy a soda or anything without seeing hundreds of these brightly colored neon stickers on everything asking, did you get your flu shot? So there I am reaching for a soda or a 12-pack of beer, and there's a sticker on the case of beer that says, flu shots, get your flu shot, flu shot, flu shot, flu shot. So this is a little op-ed I picked up from prisonplanet.com, which I usually wouldn't do, but it's an op-ed, it's not a news story. I love prisonplanet.com, I love Alex Jones, just like with every other news story, I take it with a grain of salt unless I'm able to get other evidence and other people citing the same stories. But this is an op-ed off Prison Planet written by people from the Natural News, and it says, accounts are pouring in to Natural News that Walgreens customers feel they're being verbally harassed by Walgreens employees at the checkout counter over flu shots. Well, it's not just at the checkout counter. It's every few minutes an announcement over the PA of some, hey, flu shot, flu shot, flu shot. And then, yeah, the stickers everywhere, and then on your way out, hey, have you got any flu shot yet? It's like, well, no, but I could use a penicillin shot after fucking your mother. Several readers say they're Walgreens employees. Requested not to be named. They're being rewarded with incentives and threatened with reprimands, depending on how many flu shots they're able to get. So please, people, when you're in a Walgreens, please don't blame the employees who are asking you for a flu shot, because they're having their jobs threatened. The best thing probably to do is stop shopping at Walgreens. But it's happening everywhere. So it would be nice to vote with your wallet and vote with your feet and stop showing up. But CVS and everyone else is doing the same shit.
Seasonal flu and swine flu can be scary and confusing. Today, both Walgreens and CVS stores began giving out flu shots ahead of what's predicted to be an active season.
An active season. When I was a kid, I never remember hearing shit about this. And then as I was a teenager, I remember flu shots. If you were sick, sickly or old, you might want to get one. But if you were a young buck, anywhere from the ages of like 8 to 60 or whatever it was, you didn't need one. You just had to like look at a flu shot, look at the box, and you didn't need one. You're gonna be fine. But lately, in the last like 5 years or something, it seems that they want everybody to be inoculated against whatever they say is the that year's flu du jour. Which, at the same time, studies are showing that the flu vaccines are not being very effective. This is a story I pulled from two locations, cited from MSNBC.com, as well as I believe it's a Minnesota public radio. So here we are, the MSN article. Flu shots not as effective as thought, but get one anyway, in parentheses. Flu vaccines don't work well as previously thought. Overall, flu shots in adults 18 to 65 are 59% effective. That's an estimation. These scientists reached their conclusion by pulling the results of over 31 studies in several flu seasons. There was no
no evidence pointing to how effective these flu shots were. So this NPR story goes deeper into it. New comprehensive analysis of flu studies concluded that most flu vaccines provided only a moderate protection against the flu. And some years have made no difference at all. The analysis also suggests that the people who need protection from flu, children and seniors, may be the least likely to derive any benefits from vaccines long considered important to public health. So this is a University of Minnesota infectious disease study. The resource screened thousands of flu studies published since the 1960s and found only a handful of them adequately measured the effectiveness of the flu vaccine. Most of the time, they vastly overestimated the benefits. Goes on to say, each fall, government-sponsored awareness campaigns urge Americans to get influenza vaccines for themselves and family members. As recently as last year, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention expanded its flu vaccine recommendations to include everyone 6 months and older. I think George Carlin has a little something to say about that.
Besides, what do you think you have an immune system for? It's for killing germs.
So this goes on to say that they found the vaccines about 59% effective overall in the individuals between 18 and 65. In other words, on average, more than 40% of people who received the flu vaccine had no protection at all from the flu. If we had a childhood measles vaccine that only protected, on average, 59% of the time, we'd say that this vaccine is a failure. But they want you to take it anyway. They want you to get all those nice heavy metals in your system. And I'm not talking about Judas Priest there. I'm talking about the bad kind. So, it used to be that the CDC said that 70 to 90%, that the vaccine was 70 to 90% effective. For a very long time, they said that. And then they switched it from 50 to 70%, which is a pretty major change. So even the CDC is hedging their bets a little bit. But still, they're pushing for everyone, except for the tiniest of toddler, to get the vaccine. So, in If You're Sick, Go to Jail, Go Directly to Jail News. This is from the ChicagoSunTimes.com. And this is another conversation I was having about drug stores and trying to buy cold medication. But here we go. This is by Shannon McFarland. Fine Irish name. State to track the makings for meth. Okay, so the state wants to track people making meth, I guess. That's what I'm going to understand from the headline here. So here we go. Buying a package of allergy medication at the corner drugstore will put you in a state police database under a new Illinois law aimed at identifying people who make methamphetamine. Who needs the Fourth Amendment? Right out the window. Gone. Oh, you got a sniffle? Oh, well, we want to see what's in your medicine cabinet. It reminds me very much of THX 1138.
What's wrong? Nothing really. I just feel that I need something stronger.
If you have a problem, don't hesitate to ask for assistance.
Yes, thank you. I'll be all right.
Call 348-FUNK. What's wrong?
So, stores already keep the products behind the counter to guard against theft, and they also record who buys the product. But now stores will transmit directly those records of who is buying electronically to the state police. So a quote here from, I believe, the governor of Illinois. This program is a valuable tool that helps us prevent meth from getting into our communities by stopping the production. Now, how else is this information going to be used? Okay, so you go to the store, you buy some Sudafed, they transmit to the police station that Joe Blow came in and bought some Sudafed. Now what? Is it, you know, you're driving later that day, you get pulled over, a cop says that you crossed the line. Oh, wait a minute, here, says you bought some Sudafed earlier. I think you're operating under the influence. You're arrested, you know, part of the system. You gotta make any phone calls? We could really use the money. How long are they storing this information for? Is this gonna be something that, you know, maybe you have a serious sinus infection, you're buying Sudafed, you're getting a divorce, and suddenly your wife is, your wife's lawyer's pulling these records to say that, you're a meth head. This just, not only do I feel it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment, but it also seems to just be ripe for abuse is probably the term to use here. Now in Mega Upload News. So this is from the San Francisco Gate, January 19th. MegaUpload.com, a file-sharing website, and individuals and companies associated with it were accused of running an international criminal enterprise that's caused more than $500 million in harm to copyright owners. So, after four of the defendants were arrested in New Zealand, three suspects remain at large. This is quotes, this action is amongst the largest criminal copyright case ever brought by the United States and directly targets the misuse of a public content storage and distribution site to commit and facilitate intellectual property crime. Investigators executed more than 20 search warrants in the U.S. and eight other countries, as well as seizing $50 million in assets. Prosecutors allege the conspiracy generated more than $175 million in criminal proceeds. So, $175 million criminal proceeds that caused $500 million in harm. Okay. So this case is U.S. versus Kim.com, case 12-0003 in the U.S. District Court, which, he was in New Zealand, Mr. Kim.com, the owner guy of Mega Upload, which, with all of the real scary stuff going on in the world, it's funny, our government wasting the time to seize assets of somebody that's not even in this country that they feel is violating laws in this country. First off, in my mind, all of this bullshit with the RIAA, MPAA, FUCK, all these douchebags that are buying our politicians and having them write legislation to have our government fight their wars for them, this should all be in civil court. If they feel that they were wronged, they should do what every other company has to do when they feel they've been wronged by another enterprise and sue them. Having the U.S. Justice Department be your own public, or I should say our public police being your private army, just shows how out of whack this whole system is. I'm going to go over to torrentfreak.com now. Mega Upload, what made it a rogue site worthy of destruction? This is an op-ed piece, but it also gives a lot of technical stuff that none of the other stories were touching. So, file hosting services all around the world will have looked on in horror yesterday as Mega Upload, one of the world's largest cyber locker services, was taken apart by the FBI. So what exactly prompted the action? Tort Freak read every word of the 72-page indictment, so you don't have to, and we are surprised by its contents. The manner in which the action was taken and the language used by authorities was utterly unprecedented. What made Mega Upload a rogue site, which deserved to be completely dismantled, and its key staff arrested? The answers lie in the 72-page indictment and show just how the authorities, with massive assistance from the MPAA no doubt, framed Mega's activities in such a way as to strip any protection under the DMCA. So they're saying in the indictment that they willfully infringed on copyrights themselves on their systems and had copyrighted materials on their systems and received the financial benefit directly attributed to copyright infringing activities and have not removed disabled access to known copyright infringing materials from the servers they control. Mega had developed a system whereby files set to be uploaded by users were hashed in order to discover if a copy of the file already existed on the server. If a file existed, the user did not have to upload his copy of the file and was simply given a unique URL in order to access the content. What this meant in practice is that you could have countless URLs owned by various users, but they pointed to the same file. Mega Upload's abuse tool, quote-unquote, to which maybe major copyright holders were given access to, kind of like the YouTube takedown stuff, enabled the removal of links to infringing works hosted on the servers. However, the indictment claims that it did not actually function as a DMCA-compliant tool, as the copyright owners were led to believe, and here's the reason why they say so. The indictment claims that when the copyright holder issued a takedown notice for the content, the reference URL was taken down, but not the content itself. The paper goes on to accuse Mega Upload of running a program between September 2005 and July 2011, which rewarded users for uploading infringing materials. Two key staff members knew that cash payments were being paid to users who uploaded infringing materials, including full popular DVD rips and software with key generators. Another correspondent quoted in the indictment appears to show key staff members sending each other links to copyright works hosted on Mega Upload itself. Well, that certainly hurts them if they want to try to say that they didn't know it was there. But of course, all of this, you know, they were outside of the United States, having them arrested and extradition. But let's keep going. But aside from exchanging links and copyrighted the works, the indictment claims that key staff members also uploaded material themselves, including TV shows from the BBC and a copy of the movie Taken. Why don't I know? I've never heard of this movie in my life. Am I missing something? Someone send me an email. Tell me what the hell's going on. On at least two occasions, the indictment reports key Mega Upload staff discussed Torrent Freak articles on seizure operations being carried out by the U.S. authorities. So with all of this email information, it points to either that our government, with the help of New Zealand government and other governments, was... spilled some bourbon on myself. Was either tracking their emails, reading their emails, or someone within the organization was to bypass being indicted themselves, handed over all the information. Finally, and despite the assertions of the MPAA, RIAA, and the authorities, Mega Upload carried a huge amount of non-infringing content, giving the service itself substantial non-infringement users. Nevertheless, all your content we seize, leaving millions of people and companies without their personal data. CyberLocker services and potential startups all around the world will be watching this case like hawks. That is true. Feel bad for anyone that didn't have their data backed up and they were keeping it all on a third-party site. A more valid example is if your local government closes your local dry cleaner, for some reason, then when would you get your clothes back? Who knows? Usually I don't go into the comment sections of news stories because usually just filled with people who either don't understand what they're reading, don't comprehend it, or are just redneck retards. But on TorrentFreak.com seems to be some educated people here, and this first guy, Ven, who posted this, is possibly the most important question is, what did the terms of use agreement say? So he pulled it up and went through it. So here we go. Customer has sole responsibility and liability for the data it stores on Mega Upload servers. Customer bears full responsibility for archiving its data and the sole liability for any lost or irrecoverable data. The use of the service is at your sole risk. Mega Upload services are provided on an as-is and available basis. So that pretty much answers it right there about anyone who would try to sue them down the road after a government has already reamed out their asshole. Just by using the service, if you're missing files, too fucking bad. So now, in U.S. Internet Imperialism News! This goes along the same story, the Mega Upload story. This is from the Mail Online, the Daily Mail. Naive British student facing 10 years in chains, and how our half-witted politicians play poodle to America. You gotta love this. Just right off the bat, the Brits are pissed about this story, and if you haven't heard it, I'll get into it in a second. But this is what's so great about reading stories from the original source, instead of having it go through the filter of the U.S. news, which I know the Daily Mail is part of the evil empire and everything else, but having the true words of the writer come through, it helps. So, what Richard O'Dwyer did may not have been sensible or praiseworthy, but it's highly doubtful as to whether he broke any British laws, and yet he could end up serving up to 10 years in American high-security prison. This is just another story of our police force and district attorneys being used as the private forces for our media conglomerates. Mr. O'Dwyer set up this website TV Shack in his digs, which American prosecutors allege hosted links, just links to pirated copyright films and television programs. Imagine that. I'm a share of links myself. Lots of cute kitty pictures, maybe a porn worth viewing to my friends, maybe a new album. But man, imagine that. By hosting links, you are pissing off our media overlords. What are they going to do about Facebook? That's nothing but links. So, it goes on to say that he did not download copyrighted materials himself, which explains why British authorities do not believe he has committed any crimes and have decided not to bring any charges against him. Now, I started out the show today with a clip from a BBC morning news show that was interviewing his mother and also a... I believe he was a British civil rights expert about this case and about how the U.S. government is trying to extradite this poor guy here to be charged in the U.S. for going against U.S. laws. They're bought and paid for by media conglomerates. Do we have to now think about... laws in other countries as well, or is it just that we're the big bad boys on the block and everyone in every other country should just have an American law book in their back pocket? Of course, you have it for a couple days and it'll be useless from the constant changing and skewering of laws. And of course, if you aren't breaking the law, really, they'll find something to charge you with. So, the case of Mr. O'Dwyer raises important questions of principle. It seems undeniable that the 2003 Extradition Act is sometimes being used by the American authorities in a way that was never envisioned nor intended. Then the British government is feebly accepting this unsatisfactory state of affairs. So it goes into talking about the 2003 Extradition Act, signed by Tony Blair and President George Bush at the height of the disastrous mutual infatuation. Man, this article is just filled with piss and vinegar. It was designed to deal with terrorist suspects at the time when the British government was anxious to stand shoulder to shoulder with Mr. Bush and his war on terror, TM. But the act was never meant by Parliament to ensnare such people as Mr. O'Dwyer. As Sir Menzie Campbell, the former Liberal Democratic leader, pointed out Sunday, nevertheless, this is exactly how it is being extended by the American authorities. Moreover, the system is seemingly biased against Britain. Of course. You know, we always get the long end of the stick, and if you don't like the short end of the stick with the poop on it, too bad. The U.S. requires sufficient evidence to establish probable cause before agreeing to extradite anyone to the U.K., but the Britons are denied that same protection. So far, since this act has come into place, 123 requests have been made by the U.S. for people to be extradited from the U.K., as compared to just 54 requests coming from the U.K. And this goes on even further, and has some great quotes here about, "It should still mean something to be a British citizen with the full protection of the British Parliament," which I firmly believe myself is. I am a firm believer in sovereign nations, and I think all of this is kind of like one step from invading them, isn't it? That's to just say, look, we don't care what your laws are. We feel. Well, our feelings are hurt, so we're going to charge this guy, whether you like it or not. I'm going to read one more paragraph from this article, because I feel it really puts it all in perspective. And though that treaty, the 2003 treaty, has obviously gone badly wrong, so badly wrong that a man who's committed no crimes in this country could end up in a U.S. high-security prison, our government is so accustomed to bending the knee to America that it dare not do anything to rewrite the treaty. We're pulling for you, England. as a big fan of many British bands, and loving Britain myself, the police state, nanny state that it is, I do feel the British people definitely do have the right thing in mind, and no, they don't want to be kowtowing to the U.S. government, and they shouldn't. And I hope that they hold on and push back very hard when it comes to the extradition of Richard here. To go further in this story, this is from nakedsecurity.sophos.com. Being an IT guy myself, I was interested to see this site, what they're posting about it. Now, this gives some technical aspects of why the U.S. feels it has the right to be extraditing and charging. So, turns out the TVShack.net, Richard's website, was an ICE target, but was not hosted on any servers inside the United States. But the .net suffix is managed by a U.S. registry operator VeriSign, and ICE used this link as a basis for asserting jurisdiction and prosecuting TV Shack. So, O'Dwyer is UK-based, and apart from the .net domain, there doesn't seem to be any other direct ties with the U.S., which is something I've never thought of before, that now buying a domain name, you're going to have to look at what country keeps the rights or has the jurisdiction over a domain. I thought IEEE, when domains were the whole idea of domains and everything involving it was being put together, was supposed to be a global thing. I guess I was completely wrong. It says here that .coms and .nets are under jurisdiction of the United States. So, this information was not on U.S. servers. He did not have any copyrighted materials on his site, just had links to copyrighted materials on his site. And, the way that they were able to ensnare him was the fact that he had a .net suffix on his domain, and that allowed the U.S. to, take action. So, the next thing on my mind involving all of this, as I pour myself another glass of bourbon, is SOPA and PIPA, which very happily we are all celebrating the fact that these have been shelved for the time being, but it's no time for us to sit on our laurels and ignore it. Because as I mentioned in the last show, and I'll mention again with my cynical mindset, is they're going to keep pushing for this stuff. The goal is to clamp down the internet and to make information a unreachable commodity that's controlled and twisted and dribbled out as needed. But what all of this does with such a show of force against Mega Upload and poor old Richard there in the UK is the laws as they are allow prosecution and the seizing of assets for people that they say are inflicting harm on copyrighted materials. Why do we need more laws then? If they're able to go and arrest people in other fucking countries, what else is there? All of this and all of the news stories of what happened here are the biggest argument against more laws. It says, hey, you know, you already have the super weapon. You already have the ability to blow up a tank from 500 yards. Oh, that's not enough. You need to be able to blow up the tank and then the whole village around the tank from 500 yards. It's insane. It really is. But unfortunately, part of the part of the larger plan is the dividing of the internet and the conquering of the internet, and we're all gonna be having to go dark, having to go darknet. Gotta come up with something. Okay, let's get off the bad news. Let's go to some cyberpunk kit. As before, going with the old WOG standby of what does it do, how well does it do it. This is a great little knife to stick in your bug out bag. Let's talk about this. This is the Derma Safe Knife. It's a lightweight, medium duty cutting tool. It has three beveled, hollow ground, shaving quality stainless steel razor blade in the thing. It has a plated steel rib to secure the blade, a medium impact plastic handle. It's convenient and low cost. This thing is, I think they go for $1.50 and they're sold in bulk for a lot cheaper. Weighs less than 8 grams enclosed. It has a length of less than 3 inches. This thing is currently used by the military, survival kit manufacturers, as well as electricians, painters, detailers, etc., etc. There are so many uses for it, and more become evident. Like slitting the throats of children. Wait, no, not slitting the throats of children. This is something that it's could replace a lot of the things that you need to pull your pocket knife out for and do. It's very low profile. You could probably even like insert some of these into the liner of your jacket, and no one would even notice. I love that they sell them in bulk on the website. You could buy a crap load of them. One in the junk drawer in the kitchen, a couple in your bug out bag, one in your coat pocket, one in your car, give them away as gifts. It's just a hot little knife. So this is funny too, is that the Derma Safe Knife is manufactured to military specification MIL-R-365408. There's military spec for this thing. It must be good. So, our daily hack today. This is something that blew me away. I was laying in bed with the missus, and she was reading one of her romance or mystery novels, and I had my laptop open, and I was cruising YouTube. And I thought, lockpicking. I wonder if they have anything about lockpicking. You know, we talk about security, encryption, everything else, but when it comes down to it, really the, you can have all the encryption in the world, but if your locks are substandard on your house, and if you know how easy it is to break these, you're not doing good. So, there's this guy, who goes by Shylertown on YouTube. It's youtube.com/user/Shylertown. SCHUYLERTOWNE, has a step-by-step course in the basics of how to pick locks, how locks work, and how to work around them. I think there's 20 or 25 episodes, and he starts off real slow and easy. What's exciting about this guy is not just what he does, but the instructions are clear, they're precise, and he has a two-camera setup, high-resolution camera setup. One camera is shot on him talking head style, and the other camera is focused on a lock that he's milled the side out of, so you can see the tumblers in the lock. So as he's going through the process, you could see at the same time him pushing the tumblers in the lock and how easy these locks give. Another thing I'm going to throw out to you, if you're interested in this, is another YouTube link, and this one is a little bit more Black Ops. This is a very fine link on how to make lock-picking implements. So if you decide you want to be an apprentice locksmith and you want to go and learn the true trade, there's a link on my Facebook, facebook.com/newsreelx, giving you a simple step-by-step instructions using a little Dremel grinder to make things like rakes and picks and other things. So definitely check that out. That could lead to some very interesting stories. And that's all I got for you today. But don't worry, I'll be back next week with the news you need to survive. This show is free to distribute. Give it to grandma, give it the finger, give it a chance. If you have anything you'd like to send me, you could reach me at newsreelx@gmail.com. If you like the music in the background, it's been Sleigh Bells. It's their album that just came out last year called Treats. It's been kind of an interesting mesh of like noise pop, electronic. Sometimes I think it sounds a little bit like the music of Le Tigre, but with much better vocalist. So I'll leave you with a track. I'm going to leave you with a track called Tell 'Em. As a wise man said, we'll never defeat the enemy if we're at each other's throats. Until next time, that's what Sean Kennedy should have said. In server, in strength. End of line.
Look away. You better just manage your mood.